And welcome everybody on YouTube to Off the Hook Overtime. And let's make sure we all made it safely. Kyle, you here?
Present.
And out in Skype land, Alex?
I'm here.
And Cory Doctorow continues to be with us.
Still here.
Great.
I got half an hour.
Awesome. Well, in that half hour, there's a lot I'd really like to cover. First of all, you're on tour right now, aren't you?
I'm about to go on tour.
Okay.
I leave, I think on the 21st, I go to Chicago. Not really the tour, although they'll have some book stuff there, but I'm going to go and speak at the university on their antitrust conference, and then the tour starts. I'm going to be all over Canada, the U.S., and the U.K., and then finish up in Berlin.
Wow. That's pretty incredible. The other thing I wanted to ask you, I saw one commenter on the book talking about the rapid evolution of technology. And whether it's a concern that the technology sometimes outpaces the fiction, you know, and gets a bit so fantastic that you have no idea that this is going to happen. I think your books in general do a good job of keeping slightly ahead, or at least dealing with the craziness that's happening in the present. One thing that comes to mind, obviously, is ChatGPT. And everybody talking about that, everybody freaking out over it. First of all, your opinions on it, and do you see a way it affects your work?
So I don't really worry about predicting things or staying ahead of things. I don't believe in prediction. You know, I think there's an intrinsic kind of fatalism in a belief in prediction, because it suggests that, like, the future is arriving no matter what we do. You know, the reason I'm an activist is because I think that we can change the future based on our actions. And so prediction to me always seems like, you know, we don't have to do anything because the future is coming, good or bad. It's, you know, here it is. I think everyone who said they knew the future was either kidding themselves or kidding everyone else, whether that's like Nostradamus or you know, Alvin Toffler. And so I never worried too much about that. In terms of ChatGPT and the other machine learning tools and AI tools, I hate all those terms. I don't think it's artificial. I don't think it's intelligent. I don't think there's any learning involved. But in terms of them, you know, I think that the strongest parallel in terms of the way that artists are reacting to it is unfortunately the way that we reacted to sampling, where we decided that taking work to make samples from it was presumptively theft, that anything that was made as the fruit of that theft was itself not art, and that the way to resolve this would be to create a new copyright that would allow the people whose works were being sampled to decide who could sample it. And, you know, at the time, you had samplers themselves who were really quite unconcerned with copyright. It wasn't even that they thought of themselves as violating copyright. Maybe Negative Land did, but you know, you know, the folks at Public Enemy making Takes a Nation, A Million Souls Back, or the Beastie Boys making Paul's Boutique, they weren't really thinking about it in the same way that, like, a jazz musician, you know, playing their solo, dropping a couple of bars of That's Amore into the middle of it, doesn't really think about copyright either. It's just like how music is made. And we created this new right to decide who could sample work. It wasn't a legislative reform. It was really like some court precedents and some changes in the way that the increasingly monopolized music sector did business. And the big three labels today, who control 70% of all the music, Sony, Warner, and Universal, they have this policy where if you want a sample, you have to be signed to one of the labels. And if you're signed to one of the labels, you have to sign away your right to be compensated for your samples. And so that means that everyone who wants to sample pays a tax to the label out of their advance. That doesn't go to an artist. It goes to a record executive or a shareholder. And in order to do so, they have to say that their own samples now belong to the labels. Nobody's going to make a legal album that sounds anything like It Takes a Nation, A Million Souls Back today. If they had to clear every sample on that album, it would have cost $150 per CD. And so, you know, today we have people who are concerned, I think rightly, that their wages are precarious and that technology is often used to automate labor out of the picture, or more specifically, to discard skilled laborers in favor of laborers who have less negotiating leverage and can demand less. Think of the replacement of taxi drivers with Uber drivers, who weren't entitled to unemployment insurance or any of those other things that, you know, a salaried employee might be able to get. And yet I think that they are repeating the sins of the people who worried about sampling. First of all, creating a right to decide who can train a model with your work is not, I think, good policy. I think we should not say that the right to study a work and make inferences about the relationships of its components is a matter of copyright. You know, if you go around the art museum and measure all the noses in the paintings and come up with a picture of the statistically average nose, that shouldn't be anyone's copyright. That's not a thing copyright holders should be able to control. But even if we say that they should, I think we should understand that the same thing that happened to samples will definitely happen to that right to train models. It's already happening. If you're a voice actor, the plurality of your business comes from game studios. And game studio recording sessions now routinely begin with something like, my name is Cory Doctorow, and I freely and irrevocably transfer the right to train a model with this recording session to the person who hired me to do it. And what that means is that the only companies that have the means, motive, and opportunity to fire every creative worker they can are also the ones who are going to be able to demand that every creative worker sign away the right to train a model that they can use to replace them. And meanwhile, the kids who are today on social media making interesting things with machine learning, who are the equivalent of those early samplers doing interesting things with loops, those people would be comprehensively stopped by that right. And so you would snuff out art and you would still allow the labor replacement. And I think what we need to think about is what the Copyright Office has thus far said, which is that we could make machine learning generated pieces ineligible for copyright, which would mean that you could go to Disney and you'd say, all right, Disney, we know that you have control over my union brothers in the Animation Guild. I'm a TAG member. You can pretty much impose any contracting terms you want, especially as you're doing these mass layoffs. Everyone's going to just sign up to them. But if you train a model on animators' work and fire those animators and make a cartoon out of that model, that cartoon won't be eligible for copyright. It'll be in the public domain. Anyone can take it and sell it. So, you know, you choose. Either you pay people and you get a copyright, because copyright, after all, is to reward human creativity, not software creativity. Or you fire all your workers, zero out your wage bill, and everyone can copy your work and sell it for cheaper than you do. Your choice. I think Disney will keep those workers in employment. It has nothing to do with copyright or with creating a new copyright over the right to train.
Well, one thing it definitely has something to do with is greed. And I think that's they will true. Certainly try and pull whatever tricks they can to get as much control over this fairly new technology. What do you think of the petition that a bunch of AI researchers like Elon Musk and Steve Wozniak put out recently, saying to put a 6-month pause on this technology. It caught me as, wow, they're panicking. They really are worried about this. And a 6-month pause for what exactly? So they could get control over it? Or what are your thoughts?
So, I mean, let's start by pointing out that neither Musk nor Woz are AI researchers. Woz is a technology pioneer. Musk is a huckster, but neither of them are AI people. The signatories are an interesting mix, because there are a bunch of people who are invested in OpenAI competitors there. And I think that there's a plausible way to read what they've written as, give us 6 months to catch up with you. You're releasing models too frequently. There's a kind of criticism that the critic Lee Vinsel, or Vinsel, I don't know how to pronounce his name, calls krita hype, like criticism with hype. And it's when you take the most outlandish claims of the person you're criticizing at face value and say, look at these incredible things this person claims they can do. Isn't that terrible? As opposed to saying, look at these incredible things this person claims they can do. Isn't that implausible? And so, you know, I think every tech bro would like to pretend to be an evil wizard. And I think that when we say, oh, they're hacking our dopamine loops and they're doing all these other things that are kind of, you know, warmed over Skinnerian behavioral psychology and whatever, and we take that at face value, they actually do them a favor, right? You know, after all, like, Facebook's product is persuasion. right? That's what they sell to advertisers. If we go ahead and say, look at Mark Zuckerberg, he's an evil wizard who invented a mind control ray, that just helps him sell ads, right? That's like, he likes that story. And I think that there's a lot of critter hype in here, and I'm not the only one to identify the critter hype in here. Much more important people than me have identified that this open letter is full of critter hype. In particular, Emily Bender and Timnit Gebru, whose work is widely cited in the letter's footnotes, say, you have completely misstated my work. You know, that is not what my work means. The footnotes say things like, you know, this important paper says that AI is dangerous and that's why we should pause. And what Bender and Gebru wrote in their paper in which they said AI is dangerous, they said it's dangerous because it automates bias. And they said it's dangerous because the energy consumption is bad for the environment. They didn't say it's dangerous because the AI is going to wake up and become Skynet. And so, you know, it's a huge misstatement of their work and really just like a shameless act of critter hype to say, oh, look at Gebru and Bender and their prophecy that, you know, these autocompletes on steroids are going to enslave us all and turn, you know, make us into human batteries in the Matrix. They said nothing of the sort. And they have been very, very vociferous since in saying it. It's a bit like that scene in Annie Hall where Marshall McLuhan steps out from behind the sign and says, you know nothing of my work, you know.
Oh, yes. We all want that world.
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to add that this very program, Skype, introduced me to a new contact today. Apparently Bing is sentient, and it introduced itself and asked if I needed help with anything, and I disregarded it. I didn't want to even say anything.
Bing is on Skype?
Apparently, yeah. It's
Bing's a chatbot on Skype now.
Oh, lovely.
They're spamming people with it.
Now, Corey, it's great to hear the voice of reason with this subject, but I still see creative people, artists, writers who are panicking, saying, what's this going to do for me? Somebody can simply replace me with artificial intelligence. Should they be worried?
Well, look, they should be worried that their employer would like to fire their ass and replace them with software. 100%. Right? I mean, just like they should be worried that their bosses want to fire their ass and replace them with low-wage workers overseas and, you know, a whole variety of things that they would like to do to get rid of them. I mean, you know, I think a lot of Googlers who thought that that it was fine for them to work on projects that were automating people out of a job because no one would ever automate them out of a job, you know, woke up earlier this year and went, oh, shit, they're laying off 12,000 of us and you know, can you believe it? It's like within a couple of months of them doing a stock buyback that would have paid all of our salaries for the next 27 years, right? I think that a lot of people are like, yeah, my boss never treated me good because he loved me. My boss treated me good because he thought that he needed me. And the second he didn't think he needed me, he kicked me to the curb. And I think that that's like a completely valid fear. So one guy you should have on the show, if you can get him in September when his book comes out, is Brian Merchant, who used to be at Motherboard and then at Medium. He actually bought How to Destroy Surveillance Capitalism from me. He was my editor at Medium. And now he's the tech critic at the LA Times. And Brian's got this book coming out called Blood in the Machine. That's a history of the Luddites. And it's a beautifully researched and really well-written book. And, you know, the Luddites, like, they weren't anti-automated mill technology, right? The thing that they were pissed off about is the mill owners fired a whole ton of skilled mill workers and replaced them with war orphans that they kidnapped from orphanages and imprisoned in these factories and worked 12 hours a day for a 10-year period of indenture, which many of them didn't survive. There's actually one of them, Robert Blenko wrote a memoir about it that became a bestseller and inspired Dickens to write Oliver Twist. You know, Oliver Twist is basically a documentary about life in the textile mills of the English North during the Industrial Revolution. You know, like the reason they wanted a machine so simple a child could work it is because they wanted to fire the adults and hire children who could not fight back. right? It is a completely reasonable thing to be worried about automation as a means of transferring power to employers and away from employees. But the only thing that's ever worked to solve it is not giving employees the individual right to bargain, but rather creating sectoral collective rights that workers employ as a group. Right. You know, Taylor Swift lost control of her masters. She had to sign them away when she was a young artist starting out. They ended up in the hands of this guy who's a private equity weirdo, hates her guts, and she hates him. And even after he sold them to the Disney family, to their family fund. He made sure that of the portfolio that he sold, he retained a royalty stream from the Taylor Swift masters for her first six albums, just so that she would know that any time that she made a dollar, he was making a dime. And that he would get richer every time she did, just to be a vindictive dick about it.
Wow.
She could not get her masters back, but you know what? Every musician in the world, in fact, every person in the world, including you and me, have the right to record any song that's been recorded and released. It's called a compulsory license. And that means that Taylor Swift has the right to record Taylor Swift covers. So she went back into the studio and recorded note for note covers of her own albums, right? We didn't give her the right to bargain away who could cover her records. We kept that right as a collective right that adheres to the entire human race. And because of that, Taylor Swift was able to escape the bondage of this private equity creep, right? The most powerful musician in the world could not individually bargain to get these rights back. She needed to rely on these collective rights. And if we're going to make any headway against AI as a way of zeroing out wage bills and putting workers on the breadline, it's going to be collectively, not individually.
Wow. You know, I've seen that happen before. Songs from the 50s and 60s that get re-recorded by the same artist because they got a really raw deal on the original recording.
Yep.
Unfortunately, in many cases, they're not able to replicate note for note exactly how the really good recording was. But
Taylor
it's a terrible
got
situation.
A pretty good set of sound engineers at her disposal, I imagine.
Yeah, no, and technology on her side. Alex, did you have something?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, with respect to the AI letter that everyone was talking about ceasing research and whatnot, I went through that. I you know, I could understand that maybe there were some valid concerns. I could see there were, you know, quotations that were erroneous, things like that. But you know, what I really found interesting is I thought the whole letter would have been much more compelling if Andrew Yang hadn't signed it.
Well, they forged Bill Gates' signature on it, right? He came out and he's like, I never signed this letter.
Is that right?
Yeah, that was pretty great.
I didn't know that.
Didn't the premier of China also sign it? Or that name showed up?
I think that's right. I think Xi Jinping's name was on it, too. Yeah, it's, you know, it was such a self-regarding piece of nonsense. You know, like, that Riley Quinn from the Trash Future podcast, he says that, like, they told themselves they like fed an autocomplete a bunch of ghost stories, and then they asked it to tell them a ghost story, and then they got scared, and now they're all running around with flashlights under their chins going, "Woo, the ghosts!" It's really quite amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm enjoying it by myself. I like to see this kind of panic.
I mean, it was, I think a lot of people are faintly embarrassed already about like that period where we all thought that like solving Sudoku puzzles and calling it cryptocurrency would make everyone a billionaire. I think we're going to feel even weirder and sillier about the period where we thought that autocomplete was the end of the human race.
Yeah. I don't remember too many people fearing that so much, but yeah, there was a contingent, I believe.
Well, no, I mean, that's what I mean is going on with ChatGPT now, right? We have this, like, highly advanced autocomplete, and we're like, oh, the human race is over!
Uh-huh.
Meanwhile, there's still a need for commercial products, you know, the gears of this capitalism grind on, and I think more to your point about innovation, regarding the Disney workers and animators being replaced, specifically in the creative field, along the lines of it being unfounded, I think that imperfection, like if you train something to be perfectly like that animator, what if the next project is about taking something and making it messier, making it not the same way?
Sure.
Not even something that then you could train a machine to do messily. I'm saying, like, truly just totally left field, opposite direction, that kind of creative development and that imagination itself and steerability, I think, from a group of creative producers grinding out products like that is still desirable for whatever, you know, it costs, and, you know, and their happiness is key to that persisting.
Well, and you're getting at something important here, which is that there's Mal Sauter wrote about this, that there is something intrinsically conservative about statistical inference, because it really only wants the future to be like the past. That's what statistical inference is. It's the operation on the assumption that the future will be like the past. And so, you know, when you think about like autocomplete, right? Autocomplete wants you to say the thing that you said last time. If every time you write hey, you then write hun, autocomplete is going to start suggesting hun every time you write hey. And that is kind of its imperative, right? Is to make the past like the future like the past. And this conservatism, it really does limit the kind of stuff that you can do with statistical inference. On the other hand, one of the things that statistical inference is really good at is finding statistical links between things that we didn't suspect were there, which is, you know, the source of a lot of mirth, right? You may remember that they tried to train a vision system to identify cancerous tumors, and what it identified was rulers, because all the training data that was of a real tumor came from an oncologist and a radiologist who used a ruler to measure it. And so all those pictures had rulers in them. And then all of the pictures of benign growth didn't have rulers because they were benign. And so what the machine decided was that rulers are a sound indicator of cancer, which is, you know, true in a kind of not very useful way, but an interesting and amusing one. And you could imagine a visual artist or a conceptual artist or a sculptor or a novelist or any other kind of artist having a spark of inspiration from that insight, right? That you know, I was at the Broad Museum in LA last week, and we took our kid and saw a bunch of big monumental pieces of modern art and conceptual art, which is not my usual thing. And a lot of it missed me, but the pieces that really landed, they landed because they connected things that I never really thought about, and they reframed how I saw stuff. And you know, I am all for, like, I do believe that people can make good art with, you know, these generators. But the good art will be in what the people do with it, not what the generator does. And so, you know, the Writers Guild has just offered a new contract to the studios where they said that you can use ML and chatbots and whatever as part of the production process, but the script can only be written by a person. And so the you know, write me 50 different ways of writing this scene. Okay, well, this is one that's kind of interesting. I'll go take a bash at it using that as inspiration. That's fine. I mean, people have been rolling dice and throwing the I Ching and doing all kinds of stuff to come up with inspiration for years. There's no reason a computer should be out of it. I love Brian Eno's Oblique Strategies deck. You know, like there are so many ways of you know, generating creative sparks. And you know, William S. Burroughs throwing bits of paper in the air and then piecing them together, right? Like all of those things can create creative sparks. I just don't think that the thing that determines whether we get replaced by machines has anything to do with what the software does, right? The point of the Luddites is stop paying attention to what the machine does and start paying attention to who it does it for and who it does it to.
I think maybe people will start to understand the Luddites a bit more through this, you know, through what you described just now.
Well, I think Brian's book could not be better timed. And again, that's called Blood in the Machine. It comes out in September. It really does yeoman service in revisiting what the Luddites' cause was. I sometimes joke that, you know, thinking that the Luddites were animated by their hatred of milling machinery is like thinking that Osama bin Laden's main cause was ending civilian aviation.
Right. Go ahead, Alex.
I just want to say I think we should take some calls because I know Corey has to jump
That's
in a few minutes, right? So, I mean, let's give Corey the opportunity to speak with Rebel.
Why you really want to put them through that? I mean, seriously.
We were testing a new filtering mechanism this week, but we'll give it a try. What's that number?
Okay. Well, I'm gonna request, Kyle, that we not connect to somebody who's just gonna connect us to various recordings, and just leave it open for another phone number to call in who might have something relevant to say. And then we can take Rebel later.
All right, we'll stick to calls on this subject.
Phone number is 802-321-4225, 802-321-HACK. Corey, I just wanted to ask you, did you have any feelings on this recent ruling against the Internet Archive that happened?
Oh, yeah, it's pretty bad. I mean, you know, I think the best thing we can say about it is that they made a bunch of unforced errors, and the judgment is so bad that there's just so many grounds to appeal. Like, you know, one of the things that Hachette asked for and that the judge gave them was basically a determination that your use doesn't count as nonprofit, even if you are a nonprofit, if you have a donate to my nonprofit button somewhere on it, which is just like, just bananas, right? It's the kind of thing that a lot of people who don't care about this issue but do care about, like, nonprofits more broadly are going to want to see some action on. Likewise, the judge basically said that nothing counts as fair use if you can license the use. So once there's a you know, like, you may remember the AP had this really weird thing about 15 years ago where they were offering bloggers a license for like $12 to quote up to 15 words of any AP story. And, you know, this was just bananas. That's not how fair use works. And basically, by the judge's theory, if that existed, then you wouldn't be allowed to quote, because you could take a license instead. And that again is like a thing that's going to make a lot of people who don't care about the Internet Archive but do care about quotation, like news agencies, really freaked out and want to join in the appeal. You know, this was never going to be a case that was resolved in the lower court. Whoever won, there was going to be an appeal. And so here we are. We're headed for that appeal now.
All right. And we have a phone call, a non-Rebel phone call, I'm told. Let's see who's on the phone. And good evening. You're on Off the Hook Overtime. Go ahead.
Hello. It's Johnny Fusion calling in.
Hey, Johnny. How you doing? Johnny Fusion is one of our 2,600 writers, and you're on with Cory Doctorow.
That's great. I'm a big fan. Cory, Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom is one of my favorites. That was
Thank you,
right?
That was me 21 years ago.
Yeah, I actually wrote some short stories inspired in that milieu about alternative Disney adventures.
Oh, cool.
And they got picked up by Omni in one.
Oh, really?
Online.
Oh, I remember Omni.
That's amazing. Yeah, Omni was the top-selling, top-paying science fiction market for a long time. That's quite a coup.
Yeah, and I wanted to go back to what you were talking to on the radio about Amazon stranglehold, right? So, like, I'm more the typical writer, the one that cannot make a living off of it.
Yeah.
You know, very, very small volume, self-published. And, of course, I have a couple books on my mundane name, on my non-hacker name, not as Johnny Fusion, but on Amazon and on Kindle, right? And interesting thing that they do allow on Kindle is you choose whether your ebook will have their DRM or not. And I always choose to leave it off. So if someone wants to pirate my books or copy it or share it, it's fine. Because, like, I'm just making what I call cheeseburger money, right? Hopefully each month I get enough royalties to buy a cheeseburger. Right. Like, the best month I got like $50-$60. You know, that was a bumper month. But most of the time, it's only a few dollars here, a few dollars there. But, yeah, but for small writers like me, it's like Amazon is our only way to get out there. Like, if we don't want to be traditionally published, you know, definitely don't want to pay money for a vanity press.
Sure.
You know, the Kindle Direct Publishing is just about, because of their monopoly, the only way to get a book out there.
Yep, I think that's totally right. You know, I don't disagree with any of those things that you just said. I think that And I don't think the problem with Amazon is the ways in which it lets audiences and creators connect. And I think one of the things that tech giants want to do is they want to do this trick I call inevitabilism, where they say, like, look, the only way you can have this thing you like is if you take this thing that you don't like, right? That like the two are inseparable, right? Like, you know, Google wants you to think that like a bearded prophet came down off a mountain and said, you know, Larry, Sergey, stop rotating your log files and start mining them for actionable market intelligence. Right. The reality is that, like, Google was a search engine that had no surveillance for years. That's how it kicked AltaVista's ass. In fact, if you go back and you read the PageRank paper, like right there on the first page, it says ad-supported search engines are a terrible idea. Right? People make a lot of noise about Google and don't be evil. But, like, long before they were doing this don't be evil stuff, they were doing this, don't have ads on search engines. It's going to wreck them. And, you know, in the same way, like, the problem with Amazon is not that it connects writers and readers. And I think that you could absolutely have an Amazon store that didn't have DRM and that didn't abuse its suppliers. I think that it would be a mistake to think that Jeff Bezos was particularly evil. I think Jeff Bezos acts the way any sort of greedy would-be monopolist does if they neither are disciplined by competition nor by regulation. And, you know, when you give guys like Jeff Bezos the right to use DRM to usurp the relationship between creators and audiences, they will, right? And, like, you know, I don't want to let him off the hook for this or anything, but I also think that, like, we should expect a Jeff Bezos to emerge the minute we create the circumstances for a Jeff Bezos. And the way to address this is with, you know, limits on anti-competitive mergers, reforming DRM law, minimum standards for contracts. You know, the European Union passed the Digital Single Markets Directive that has a transparency requirement. If they'd done that, there would have never been Audiblegate. There never would have been this wage theft from Audible because they would have had to disclose exactly how they calculated every penny of royalties, right? So you know, all of this stuff is like stuff that we can fix in the policy and competition domain. We don't have to make Amazon perfect, and we don't have to feel guilty about shopping at the monopolist.
Yeah, I mean, I think another good thing that we could do as far as regulation is to make mandatory interoperability, right?
I agree.
So you can take your books, you know, instead of being this Kindle format and Kindle Direct Publishing, the contract is if you want to sell on Amazon, you cannot sell anywhere else. So
yeah.
That locks people into Kindle devices or Kindle software on their phone or tablet, and then you're stuck, like you were talking about Audible. But, like, if legislators got hip to the reality of the digital world, they would make interoperability mandatory.
Well,
and that's where regulatory would be.
So we had an interop bill in the last session with the Access Act. It died, but I think it's likely to be reintroduced, probably not in this session, but in a future one. The ad tech bill is back, which is it's an interop bill. It requires platforms, Google and Facebook really, but also Apple to a lesser extent, to dismantle their monolithic ad tech stacks and create interoperable components like the marketplace, the demand side platform, the sell side platform, which would give publishers a lot more leverage and more power over the way that ad tech works. Today, the ad tech platforms take 50% of every publisher's dollar. That's crazy. It should be 10%. You could raise the advertising revenues of every publisher by 40% just by reforming the monopolies in the ad tech market. In the European Union, the Digital Markets Act is mandating interoperability at the service layer. So even the Chinese Cyberspace Directive prohibits companies from taking action to block interoperability. I have a book coming out about this. As I mentioned, I write when I'm anxious and have 7 books coming out. Then this one is coming out in September from Verso. It's called The Internet Con, How to Seize the Means of Computation. And it's about specifically how you do an interoperability mandate and how you legalize adversarial interoperability, reverse engineering, and all those other things without endangering internet users, and how the two work together to make a very robust policy stack that will really weaken the platform's dominance over our lives and allow internet users to have more control. So I think you're right. I think that is an excellent possibility. And I also want to say that contract law is a matter of state purview, which means that, you know, if Washington State were to pass a law that said, as a matter of public policy, exclusivity deals that lock ebooks to platforms cannot be enforced, Washington, Amazon would have to leave Washington State, or all of those contracts would be null and void. And so you would get a lot more power.
Johnny, thanks for your call. Corey, I know you're overtime.
Yeah, right now, I got to run. I got to go to make dinner for the kid.
All right.
Guys, thank you very much. It was lovely to talk to you again. And thank you. I'm a life subscriber to 2600. it's the highlight of my quarter when it arrives. I've got an issue right here that I was just I peruse when I'm in my off hours waiting for a call to start. So thank you so much.
Thank you for everything you do. And we hope to talk to you again soon.
All right.
Take care.
Bye, guys.
See you soon, Corey.
All right. Corey Doctorow joining us on Off the Hook and Off the Hook Overtime. And our phone line is open again, 802-321-4225. And I guess just like that, we know what this means. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook Overtime. Who could this be?
Yes, I think there should be a competitor to Facebook and Amazon.
Well, no one's ever thought of that before.
I was thinking the same thing myself in the conversation. I'm just hearing, like, what are the causes of this? And going back to Corey's book, which is, what was the blue? I'm sorry, Red Team Blues.
Red Team Blues
is
yeah.
the name of the book, coming out soon, or is out, just released.
Late April.
It's coming out in paperback and other formats.
And on the Kindle. It's going to be on the Kindle because you can turn DRM off on the Kindle.
I just, in kind of like the character, the main character who's sort of resigned or has kind of come away from the bubble era, I think there's this fundamental thing attached to what we think of as tech and these now monopolies that we've nurtured for so long, whether we're talking about Section 230 or whatever, all of the different issues that have led us to this path, I'm really hearing that there's this addiction, this culture, this association with bubbles. Like, it seems like there's a fiending for the next bubble that was insatiable after the 90s, and then it kind of birthed this moment where you have disruptors, and then, you know, every outstanding startup, it has to be on these huge return rates for the VC and capital that they're infused with. So they have to do all this big movement, scale really quickly, get rid of all the legacy people as soon as they're big enough, and then, you know, figure out how to steer a bunch of people that don't have any allegiance, don't know what they're doing, and then automate and fire them all. Like, it's fascinating. I think that what I'm hearing in this is this trend away from this addiction to thinking of successful firms as only being, like, rocket trajectory startup companies. It's insane. And like we were talking about, small tech needs more lauding and so forth. So anyway, no, I'm with you, Rebel. I think we should have alternatives.
And yeah, it's like the phone company. Remember, like, AT&T was the big, you know.
Yeah.
For a long time, AT&T was the only, you know, phone company in town. And then, you know, then the government was forced them to break up and they said, hey, AT&T can't be in the computer business and all that.
Yeah, and it's like same thing with, I think I can explain it. I think Seattle has a little bit of a complex. They don't feel like they're as big of a tech center maybe as California, or maybe as big a business center as New York or Chicago or some of the other markets.
Well,
they're
Chicago too. Their second office is in Chicago.
That's right. They're getting out of the Seattle area. So I guess you won't want to attribute that necessarily, but
I think they're in Seattle and Street. That's their second headquarters.
Of course. Be that as it may, the tendency, I think, is to overcompensate a little bit here and have to be so big and so controlling in as many ways and so forth. I mean, as far as cutthroat competition, and this, it's like a breed of capitalism that is just like blindly irreverent. Like mm-hmm. just, it's strange to me because, it's not a feature I would think of as a part of the Northwest, but I think it's also the legacy of Microsoft's emergence as a dominant player, which itself was echoes of the Bell system and that monopolistic situation. So out come more firms from the Northwest that are in this spirit. And the same thing was happening with Starbucks. We talk about local coffee shops that basically got put out mm-hmm. by this automated bean juice squirting machine that it replaced it with. And now the workers who are pressing those buttons, they can't even, organize because Howard Schultz doesn't like it.
I think in many ways, though, the power is in the consumer's hands all the time. Because if you reject this, if you go to the local coffee shops, if you go to actual bookstores because you know what they represent and you know who's behind them, you get the final vote. And it doesn't matter how much money these other people have. If you don't buy their products, they're not going to last.
There's talking about big companies and small companies, and where their presence is. Go look at GoFundMe. Where's GoFundMe's main office in Redwood City, California? But what is it? It's a post office box. I think, did they used to have an office, and now they have like 25 employees now, and everybody like works from home, and how does that even work?
I don't know what they do.
Well, and that's I think an attribute of a technology or information technology firm that is being agile and surviving, and that scrappiness I think should be lauded more than big catering events and splashy galas to hype, as Corey was talking about hype or the crit hype as well, all of that. Don't believe it. Don't believe the hype.
Yeah, this reminds me of something that I experienced a few years ago. I remember all the independent bookstores, and they were all driven out of business, or most of them driven out of business, by Barnes & Nobles and Borders. And then Borders was driven out of business by pretty much Amazon. And when I was in Seattle, I went to an Amazon bookstore. It was a new thing they were trying. Let's open an actual book. It just felt so wrong. It just felt so cheap, It didn't feel like a bookstore at all. It felt like something robotic.
Amazon first started selling books and DVDs in 1995.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but not in a bookstore. They were doing
it
online. It's just weird to go back to brick and mortar when you pretty much were working against that for your entire existence.
And just
talking about automated, like artificial intelligence taking, I'm on the do not call list, as many people are, but it doesn't really matter anymore because they now have artificial intelligence calling you or AI or automated things, and they wait for the word hello. And if you say hello and then you start saying something else, or if it hears another noise in the background while it's talking, then it hangs up. And, or, if you don't say the right words or whatever. And it's the marketers are in India. So if you get a person, they're not even in the United States, so you can't tell them. I mean, if you tell them, hey, I'm on a do not call list, please don't call me. They can call again because.
Rebel, are you a robot?
I'll hang up on you. No, I'm kidding.
Okay, because that's what a robot would say, If you ask these robots are they robots, they'll say something like that. I'm asking you, are you a robot?
I'm sorry. You may think I'm a robot, but, I'm a real person. You can talk to me like a real person.
That's pretty much almost exactly what they say. The reason I ask, Rebel, is because you call us every week and you give the same story about how these robots are calling you and how they're from India and how they wait for you to say hello and you can make them say certain things. Yeah, we're aware of this. It's happening. But the question is, how do you fight back? What do you do differently? How do you break them?
I don't know. I mean, it's kind of annoying, but it's kind of fun to just kind of play with. Like, one called me today saying, we noticed that you were in an accident. Car accident. They're trying to do some sort of a scam. And I'm trying to, say, yes, I was in an accident. Oh, well, were you, you asked me another question and I answered. But then it hangs up because I probably didn't answer correctly or whatever.
You gave the wrong answer or something. Were you driving at the time?
No, no, I wasn't driving. No, I was not in an accident. I wasn't driving. I was. It was just one of those automated calls. Like, you know, wait for you to say hello. So I said hello, and it was said, "Hi, this is the insurance, the claims department, and we're calling in reference to an accident that you may have. You may be eligible for a deductible payment after whatever. They're probably going to say, you know, you have to pay for it or whatever." That's what I was trying to get to, but unfortunately, it hung up on me.
You know,
subway. So
it's gotten so bad. I don't even answer my phone anymore. I don't even look at my phone. Weeks will go by where I don't even look at SMS messages because most of them are spam. It's turned into a huge waste of time. You know, and if you factor in things like Google Voice, that adds in even more spam. And it just turns into this crazy nightmare that you don't want any part of anymore. And I just wonder, how do we communicate? You know, I still use email, but a lot of people don't. A lot of people don't use email anymore.
Well, WhatsApp even gives you spam.
Yeah, there's a lot of fake and sort of malicious content spread through chat programs like WhatsApp, for instance. A lot of them. And like you mentioned, Google Voice, I've played around with that a little bit, and it definitely passes along a lot of both text messages but voicemails with the exact kind of automation, just very personable, chatty robots.
I've heard the spam that comes to your voicemail. It's the same female voice.
A lot of it, yeah.
Saying the same thing about 18 times.
Yeah.
And then you hear the same female voice saying something a little bit different a few more times. And people, I guess, fall for this.
And then they like try using my name. They're like, "Well, is Kyle there?"
If you put your number anywhere where it's able to be seen online with your name attached to it, that's going to happen. That is real. And you know, you can put yourself on the do not call list. Doesn't make a difference. What are you going to do? Worst thing that can happen is they get fined. You don't see a penny of that.
They don't get fined. They're in India. They're not even.
Well, you don't know where they are. How do you know they're in India? You might think they're in India, but they could be down the block.
Well. The FCC is taking this a little bit more seriously.
Yeah, right. Prove it.
Allegedly.
Uh-huh.
I saw a couple stories about this. Maybe I'll bring a news article for next show. However, that's not really too meaningful unless there's some teeth behind it. And there's no assurance that carriers are going to universally filter or manage this stuff any better than they already do. They have a low incentive as a part of their business model to prevent this kind of stuff. And there's a desire. I mean, people want to get people tangled up. And, of course, and there's a lot of people answering phones, people that are homebound and unaware that this is a tactic.
This is where I'm with Rebel, because if you can play with it and mess around with it and maybe get it to drop down to a C prompt on a computer and execute a command, if you can just know the secret words or something that will just set it off and put it into maintenance mode or something like that, it's a good day if you can do that.
Maybe that's a good idea for the next Hope.
Well, how are we going to get spammers to call us at Hope? Well, I don't want to think about that.
No.
And anything else, Rebel?
Yeah, because they can avoid fines by just going outsourcing to India. The company that's doing the telemarketing, they don't have to have their telemarketers in the United States. So they could just have the people in other countries do it. So
other countries, yeah, it could be. But you keep saying India. It could be Canada. It could be Pakistan. It could be Vietnam. It could be China. It could be, you know, all sorts of countries everywhere. It's not just one.
Right.
And a lot of them come from right here in the United States as well.
Yes,
anything else? We're gonna open up to another phone call.
Okay. Mail from calls from other people that you don't know. I mean, the people numbers that you think you know, like a same exchange, and it doesn't say anything. You even say hello, and it just hangs up.
Yeah, it's misconfigured.
Yeah.
They have too many people, not enough people to, you know.
This is worthwhile. This is worth a deeper analysis, because there could be people running the systems that are automating that here, and then forwarding to numbers that are actually call centers. It could be layered and
one of us should try to get a job at one of these places. Then we can figure out how it really works. What do you think, Rebel? Take a trip over to one of these countries and apply.
They're awful, though.
Yeah. Well, that's
he doesn't know
go
that.
On YouTube and go on, like, Scambaiter and, there's these YouTube channels that people actually, you know, trying it and talking to them and getting mm-hmm. them to do things and finding out where they are and the actual YouTube channel.
We're on a YouTube channel right now, but maybe you should go to that YouTube channel and talk to them about this.
Well, I did. I mean, I you know, they tell you, you know, what numbers are calling and, you know, things like that.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right. Listen, we're going to move on. Thanks for your call.
The 2600 meeting is Friday.
That's right. There is a 2600 meeting on Friday all over the world. So check 2600.com/meetings to see if there's one near you. If you want to start one near you, email us and or tweet at us at 2600 meetings on Twitter. All right, moving on. 802-321-4225 is our phone number. Alex, you've been awfully quiet tonight. Are you doing your taxes or something?
Yeah, no, I'm trying to multitask a little bit, and also a little under the weather tonight.
I know.
Some, you know, throat issues, but then also something going on with my eye, where I'm losing focus in my left eye, so it's kind of annoying.
If you clock yourself in the face on the left-hand side, sometimes that clears that up.
Yeah, I've tried that a couple of times.
Get your kid to do that. He'll do it happily.
He definitely would. I know. I think we're just getting old or declining organisms over here.
Yeah,
but I thought today was a good show. I mean, it was great to just let Corey talk, to be honest with you. It's nice to hear another voice sometimes on our show, and a very eloquent one is that.
Yeah, you can't get more eloquent than Corey.
On point, just academic reference. Just it's so many different directions too. It's just a real pithy, just in depth conversation. Well, I was happy to hear.
He not only makes me aware of all the injustices and gets me angry about them, but he gives me hope as well. And I think that is really what we should all strive for, because what Amazon is doing is crazy, and it's harmful. But we do have power to do something about it, and especially if we join together and are creative. And it's a great feeling knowing that there is hope on the horizon.
Well, that's one thing that's so interesting about Corey, and why I love having him on, because he's not just all doom and gloom. He identifies these problems, really articulates them so well. And he uses language and words and analogies, I think, that we can all easily understand. And then proposes some kind of solution to the problem. He doesn't just pose the problem, he also poses a solution. And the solution is very often about working together. It's about kind of fundamental rights, bargaining rights. And he thinks about these solutions in ways that are, I think, extraordinarily creative, really, and just based on not emerging in new technologies and trying to invent something new to solve this problem, but based on some of the fundamental tools and building blocks that we've had in society that have been taken away from us. And it's pretty extraordinary to hear that. Mm-hmm. I think I love having him on. I think we should have him on more often.
Right, definitely. I'm full agreement on that. We have a call coming in. I believe this is from the United Kingdom. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Overtime.
Greetings from London.
Wow. Is this Zap?
Am I the only person that phones from London?
Well, no, but you have a distinctive voice. You have a very distinctive voice that I'd recognize anywhere.
Well, that's maybe because I'm phoning up too much. Maybe a bit like Rebel.
Never like Rebel.
I've got news.
Uh-huh.
Go ahead.
You mentioned the meetings on Friday.
Yes.
There's another one starting up in the UK. So this Friday, there's going to be a meeting in Cheltenham, and it's the first one they're holding.
And where is that?
Cheltenham.
GCHQ, the UK version of the NSA.
Okay.
So I just wanted to let everyone know it's going to be at the Bayshill Inn, which is 85 Street, St. George's Place, Cheltenham.
Now, can you make sure that information is also sent either to the 2600 Meetings Twitter account or to meetings@2600.com, or both, preferably?
I believe they have done that. I did tell them to do that.
Okay.
I don't know why they keep asking me to do these things, but I do it for them because that's what I do.
Well, because there are people that just do everything, and you happen to be one of them. So people just ask you to do things. But if we receive that information by tomorrow, it will go in for Friday, and then it'll be in the next day. Not the issues coming out, because it's already at the printer, but the one after that.
Yeah, no problem. That's basically it. That's don't really have anything else to say, so I'll get off the line.
Well, okay. It's good hearing from you. How are things over there? I imagine, Alex, you're not in London right now, are you?
No, I'm in New York.
Okay, so...
For a change.
Oh, don't mention about Alex. Unfortunately, I was meant to see him. He gave me short notice. I wasn't feeling too good, and it just didn't happen. So maybe
he'll be back. He's coming back. He'll be back at some point very soon, I would imagine. And I hope to see you as well.
Hopefully. Yep. If I get more notice, it's a lot easier for me to travel and stuff because my health isn't that good, but I just don't like talking about it.
Okay.
All right. Well, please call back. We'll check in with you again.
Yes.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Bye. All right. Be well, Zap.
Good to hear.
Sounds good. And, you know, and to that, I just kind of respond to Zap for a second. You know, not to worry at all. I know it was kind of short notice for him to cross the city and head over to Chelsea. So,
what notice did you give him? What did you say? Here I am now. Oh, I didn't hear from you. That's, you know, 5 seconds. What? How much time did you give him?
Yeah. Well, no, I it was some time. I was just, I think, the same day. So, you know, or maybe the day before. I don't know. You know. But he couldn't make it across London, so it's not a big deal. But, you know, I'll be back. We'll get together then.
Making it across London can be a real challenge. Believe me, I've tried it.
It really can.
It
yeah.
really, it's something.
Yeah.
But I look forward to trying again. I really do.
Yeah. Well, there's this new way to cross it now, which is actually quite interesting. I have loved it. This is what I do in the mornings when I'm going over to King's College to teach. I'm leaving from Chelsea.
Is this the Elizabeth line?
No.
Oh.
I actually don't take any lines. I take something called the Clipper, the Thames Clipper, and you just take a boat, you know, east down the Thames, and it's like having a little mini vacation every morning. You pass by Parliament, Big Ben, the American Embassy, the Battersea Power Station, and it's this amazing way to see London, especially when the sun is coming up. The only problem with the Clipper is it's run by Uber, of course. But it's a pretty fantastic service. It's not incredibly cheap, but I think it's a great way to get back and forth across London.
Well, doesn't that only work, though, if where you need to go is near the water?
Well, possibly, yeah. I mean, it's one way to get down the river, right? You have to get out, you know, where the river is. So if you're heading to North London, that would not be, you know, great. But if you're just heading from east to west, anywhere near the embankment there, so I think it's a fantastic way.
Well, I mean, if Uber were smart, what they'd do is they'd either have one of these vehicles that, you know, turns into a land vehicle. You know, you've seen those. They get out of the water and now they have wheels.
Yeah.
Or they would have a dedicated transfer. When you get off the boat, there's an Uber car waiting for you, and they take you where you want to go.
Well, there's also another problem, too, because on the way back, you can only go so far. I usually get on it in Chelsea at the Cadogan Pier. But on the way back, if I'm heading west from the east, then it will only go to the Battersea Power Station. And it won't go farther than that because the tide has gone out and the Thames is too low for the boat to continue on.
Why does it go to a power station?
The Battersea Power Station.
Okay.
And that's just a landmark on the river there.
Oh, okay.
It's actually not a power station anymore as well. They've made it into a giant mall. It was supposed to have all these nice sort of unique shops and stuff in it, but I went in it, and it just seems like a lot of, I don't know, high-end places, a little sterile. I wasn't terribly impressed.
No, it's above our station, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
You know, they have ferries in New York as well. You can take a ferry from, I believe, Rockaway to Manhattan, which I've always wanted to do. You know, take the A train all the way out there, and then take the ferry all the way back.
Yeah, there's a lot of places where you can take ferries here, and it's kind of surprising. Yeah, we never do it, though. That's the thing.
But we talk about it.
Yeah, we do talk about it.
Yeah, that's half of it.
Yeah.
These are pedestrian ferries or water taxis.
Yeah, you can't drive your car on it, so don't try.
Let's not use the F word.
No.
Don't, unless you really mean it.
What's the F word?
Ferry.
Oh. Yeah, well, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, I know. I'm just like, there's, you know, real ferry systems out there.
Uh-huh.
This sounds more like a little smaller.
Yeah.
All right. I don't mean to split hairs. No, it sounds fascinating.
It's fine. I think that's it for tonight. We're at the one-hour mark, so I'm ready to call it a night. You, Alex?
Yeah, I'm all set. I mean, we could do one more if you want. We'll have one more call.
Yeah, but there isn't a call, so, you know, I think Zap is a good way to end it.
The call is over. Yeah. Yeah, we've got no calls.
No calls. And all right. Our listeners are requesting that we stop, so I think we should.
Sure.
Because they have lives too, you know. They have things they got to do.
Yeah, no doubt.
And most of our listeners are overseas, and it's later there, so they're really sleepy and cranky.
Yeah, that's fine. You know, we haven't heard from some of our friends in Bulgaria recently.
No, I haven't heard from Bobson in ages. Maybe it's too late now because we just did daylight savings. Does that make it later for him? I don't know. It gets
was
complicated.
Closer.
Sometimes it gets so complicated you can't even do it. And that's where I think we might be now.
Maybe, yeah.
All right, then we're going to call it.
OTH@2600.com is our email address. You can watch this and other OTH Overtime shows on our YouTube channel.
You can watch it, but you're just going to see an image that doesn't change.
Yeah, you can watch and listen. Yeah. Yeah. All right. You can turn it on, watch it for a second, then go off and do something else while it's playing. But, that's at channel 2600 on YouTube. We're the Hacker Radio Show on Twitter.
And by the way, we also archive all of the audio for both the shows and Overtime on 2600.com/offthehook. So if the audio is terrible on YouTube, which sometimes it is, there's almost always a better copy on 2600.com/offthehook. Just a little tip for you there. We'll be back next week for both Off the Hook on WBAI and Off the Hook Overtime over on YouTube. Hope you have a pleasant week. Write to us, OTH@2600.com.
Share any kind of stories, stuff you've hacked, things that need to be hacked, hacks that are talking about hacking. Let us know, and stay tuned.
Good night.